This is Audible.
Bantam Doubleday Dell Audio Publishing presents Potshot by Robert B. Parker. Chapter 1. She was wearing a straw hat, pulled down over her forehead, a short flower dress, no stockings, and white high heels. A lot of blonde hair showed under the hat. Her face was nearly angelic and looked about 15, though the fact that she wore a wedding ring made me skeptical. She marched into my office like someone volunteering for active duty, and sat in one of my client chairs with her feet flat on the floor and her knees together. Nice knees.
You're Mr. Spencer.
I am. Lieutenant Samuelson of the Los Angeles Police Department said I should talk to you. He's right, I said.
You know about this already?
No, I said, I just think everybody should talk to me.
Oh, yes. My name is Mary Lou Buckman.
How do you do, Mrs. Buckman?
Fine, thank you.
She was quiet for a moment, as if she wasn't quite sure what she should do next. I didn't know either, so I sat and waited. Her bare legs were tan. Not tan as if she'd slathered them with oil and baked in the sun, tan as if she'd spent time outdoors in shorts. Her eyes were as big as Susan's, and bright blue. Finally, she said,
I would like to hire you.
Okay.
Don't you want to know more than that?
I wanted to start on a positive note, I said.
I don't know if you're serious or if you're laughing at me, she said.
I'm not always sure myself, I said. What would you like me to do? She took a deep breath.
I live in a small town in the foothills of the Sawtooth Mountains called Potshot. Once it was a rendezvous for mountain men, now it's a western retreat for a lot of people, mostly from L.A., with money, who've moved there with the idea of getting their lives back into a more fundamental rhythm.
Back out of all this now, too much for us, I said.
That's a poem or something, she said.
Frost, I said. She nodded.
My husband and I came from Los Angeles. He was a football coach, Fairfax High. We got sick of the life and moved out here, there, actually. We ran a little tourist service, take people on horseback into the mountains and back, nothing fancy, day trips, maybe a picnic lunch.
We ran a service, I said.
I still run it. My husband is dead.
She said it as calmly as if I'd asked his name. No effect. I nodded.
There was always an element to the town, she said. I suppose you could call it a criminal element. They tended to congregate in the hills above town, a place called the Dell. There's an old mine there that somebody started once, and they never found anything and abandoned it. Along with the mine buildings, they are, I suppose, sort of contemporary mountain men, people who made a living from the mountains. You know, fur trapping, hunting, scavenging. I think there are people still looking for gold or silver or whatever they think is in there. I don't know anything about mining. Some people have been laid off from the lumber companies or the strip mines. There's a few leftover hippies and a general assortment of panhandlers and drunks and potheads.
Which probably interferes with the natural rhythm of it all, I said.
They were no more bothersome than any fringe people in any place, she said. Until about 3 years ago.
What happened 3 years ago?
They got organized, she said. They became a gang.
Who organized them?
I don't know his real name. He calls himself the Preacher.
Is he a preacher?
I don't know. I think so. I don't think he's being ironic.
And there's a problem, I said.
The gang lives off the town. They require the businessmen to pay protection. They use the stores and the restaurants and bars and don't pay. They acquire businesses in town for less than they're worth by driving out the owners. They bully the men, bother the women.
Cops?
We have a police chief. He's a pleasant man, very likable, but he does nothing. I don't know if he's been bribed or if he's afraid or both.
Sheriff's department?
The sheriff's deputies come out if they're called, she said. but it's a long way, and when they arrive, there are never any witnesses. So why are you telling me all this? She shifted in her chair and pulled the hem of her skirt down as if she could cover her knees, which she couldn't. She didn't seem to be wearing any perfume, but she generated a small scent of expensive soap. They killed my husband.
I'm sorry, I said.
He was in the Marine Corps. He played football in college, she said. He was a very courageous man, an entirely wonderful man. Her voice was flat and without inflection, as if she were reciting something she'd memorized. He wouldn't pay the Dell any money, she said, so they killed him.
Witnesses?
No one has come forward.
How do you know it was the, Dell, I said.
They threatened him if he didn't pay. Who else would it be?
And you want me to find out which one did it?
Yes, and see that they got to jail.
Can you pay?
Yes, up to a point.
We'll come in under the point, I said.
She shifted in her chair again and crossed her legs and rested her folded hands on her thigh.
Why didn't you just sell and get out, I said. Move to Park City or someplace.
There's no market for homes anymore. No one wants to move there because of the Dell gang.
And you knew Samuelson from your L.A. days.
His son played for Steve, my husband.
And you asked him about getting some help, and he suggested me.
Yes, he said you were good, and you'd keep your word.
A good description, I said.
He also said you were too sure of yourself, and not as funny as you thought you were.
Well, he's wrong on the last one, I said, but no need to argue.
Will you do it?
Okay, I said.
Just like that?
Yep.
What are you going to do?
Come out and poke around.
That's all?
It's a start, I said.
Chapter 2
Potshot was in a valley in the early stages of ascending foothills, which became at some indeterminate point the Sawtooth Mountains. There were ostentatious homes above the town. The town was expensive faux western with wooden sidewalks and places with names like the Rattlesnake Cafe and the Coyote Grill. There was a three-story hotel that called itself the Jack Rabbit Inn. It had a wide front porch. Inside, the first floor had a registration desk, a restaurant, and a bar in the lobby. To the right of the registration desk, there was an open stairway leading up to the bedrooms. My room was one flight up, and my window looked down on the main drag. The street was nearly empty. A man and woman wearing cowboy hats over $200 haircuts crossed the street below my window. They got into a Range Rover complete with brush gear. The spirit of the Old West. One of Spencer's rules of detection is, never poke around on an empty stomach. So I unpacked, got my gun, and went down for a club sandwich and a draft beer at the near-empty bar in the lobby. The bartender was a slim guy with a ponytail. He was wearing a Western-style shirt and kept himself busy slicing lemons and putting them in a jar.
"I hear you have some trouble around here," I said.
He stared at me as though I had just told him I was going to shoot myself in the forehead.
"Like what?" he said.
"Like the gang from the Dell," I said.
"I don't know anything about it," he said.
"You know the preacher?" I said.
"Nope.
Guy named Steve Buckman got killed a while back. You know what happened?
You a cop or something?"
"Or something," I said.
"I already told Dean all I know, which is nothing."
"Dean?"
"The chief of police."
"So you don't know anything," I said. "Got any guesses?"
"No."
The bartender went back to his lemons. I finished the club sandwich.
"Do you know how to make a vodka gimlet?" I said.
The bartender finished slicing a lemon and looked up at me.
"Sure," he said. "You want one?"
I got up from the bar. "No," I said. "I just wanted to end the conversation on a positive note." Outside, the heat was astonishing. I walked past the sporting goods store with fishing rods and nets and waders and tackle boxes in the window. I went in and felt the welcome shock of the air conditioning. The front of the store was devoted to fishing tackle and hunting knives. In the back it was guns. There was a rack of expensive hunting rifles across the back wall. Along the side wall was an array of shotguns, and in the glass display case under the counter was a collection of big-caliber, single-action, Western-style handguns. There were elaborate tooled leather gun belts and holsters for sale, and ammunition and self-loading equipment and cleaning kits. The clerk wore a red plaid shirt with a string tie held by a silver clip. I leaned my forearms on the counter above the handgun display. "Sell many of these?" I said.
"Some."
"I'm new around here. What do I need to have in order to buy a handgun?"
"Proof of residency," the clerk said, "like a driver's license."
"Same for the long guns," I said.
"You bet. Care to look at anything?"
"My driver's license is from another state," I said.
"We can ship anything you buy to a dealer in your area."
"Who buys the handguns?" The clerk frowned.
"Hell," he said, "I don't know. They got a local driver's license. I sell them a gun. I don't care who they are. Why would I?"
"No reason," I said. "I was just wondering who would want to pack one of these howitzers." The clerk shrugged. "Maybe the guy who killed Steve Buckman," I said.
"He was shot with a 9, the clerk said.
"By whom?" The clerk shrugged.
"Why you asking me?"
"You're here."
"Yeah, but why are you interested?" he said.
"Just a curious guy," I said. He shook his head as if I were ridiculous and moved down the counter to another customer. His interest in me had plummeted. I didn't mind. I was used to it. When I left the store, the heat was tangible, like walking into a wall. I turned left and strolled the boardwalk. No one was about in the implacable sunshine except me. Mad dogs and Englishmen, I thought. In all directions but west, the hills rose up from the town in slow, curved slopes until, distantly, they became mountains. It produced the odd effect of simultaneous vastness and enclosure. I felt as far from home as I'd ever been, which was an illusion. California was farther, and Korea was much farther. But the land was so different, so un-Eastern, and maybe more to the point, Susan wasn't here. She hadn't been in Korea either, but I hadn't known her then, and while not knowing her made a hole in my existence, I didn't know it at the time. At the end of the main drag, across the street from a Western ware shop, and next to a place called Ringo's Retreat, was a small building made of beige bricks, with a hip roof and a blue light and a sign outside that said, "Police." I went in. It was one air-conditioned room, two cells across the back. A Winchester rifle and a Smith & Wesson pump gun were locked in a cabinet behind a big oak desk with an engraved brass sign on it that said, "Chief." At the desk, wearing a khaki police uniform, was a rangy guy with blonde hair and soft blue eyes.
"Good afternoon, sir," he said when I came in.
"Hot," I said.
"Yes, but it's a dry heat," he said.
"The same thing could be said of hell."
He laughed. "What can I do for you?" he said.
"You the chief?"
"Dean Walker," he said, and smiled.
"Spencer," I said. "I'm an investigator from back east."
"Boston?" the chief said.
"Betrayed by my accent," I said.
"I can pick Boston out at 100 yards, he said.
"Anyone can." "I'm trying to find out what happened to a guy named Steve Buckman," I said.
"Stevie," Walker said. "What a shame."
"You knew him?"
"Oh, absolutely. Great guy."
"Ever find the shooter?" I said.
"No, had no evidence. Still don't."
"Any suspects?"
"None."
"I heard he'd been threatened by some people from the Dell."
"I heard that, too," Walker said.
"From?"
"Lou, his wife."
"And?"
"She can't identify the people who made the threats. We even went up to the sheriff's substation in Gilcrest, looked at mug shots. She couldn't find anybody."
"So," I said, "no witnesses, no names, no clues, just a rumor."
"Exactly," Walker said.
"Case still open?"
"Well, theoretically, but you know the score. Nothing plus nothing equals."
"You have a theory," I said.
"Stevie was, Stevie thought he was a tough guy. He was pretty aggressive. Maybe he got aggressive with the wrong guy."
"Anything special he might get aggressive about?"
"Nothing I know about," Walker said.
"How about the wife?"
What about the wife? Walker said.
When a married person gets killed, who's the first suspect? I said.
Hell, are you accusing your own client?
Just asking about standard procedure.
Walker's soft blue eyes got somewhat less soft, but his tone didn't change. Just an open, friendly guy.
Hey, Spence, he said, you come all the way out here from Boston to tell me how to do my job?
You're the only cop in town?
Got four patrolmen, Walker said. There's a sheriff's substation about 40 miles east, and if I get in over my head, they'll send a deputy out.
You get in over your head much?
Walker smiled.
Hell no. This is a town full of yuppies with too much dough. I feel like I'm showboating if I carry a gun. Was it Mary Lou hired you or somebody else?
How about the Dell, I said. Again, the eyes changed, but the rest of him was friendly.
A bunch of overaged hippies, he said. Don't bother anybody.
And the preacher?
Walker shook his head.
Don't know them. They all got strange names out there, you know, Moondog, Dapper, names like that, and they're probably smoking a little cannabis. But hey, I start cracking down on people smoking dope, I'll have most of the town in jail. Technically, the Dell's not in my jurisdiction anyway. It's county land.
So they're not doing anything wrong, and if they are, it's the county's problem. Walker pointed his finger at me with the thumb cocked, and winked and dropped the thumb.
There you go, he said.
Chapter 3
Mary Lou Buckman lived in a smallish one-story house with white siding on a cul-de-sac at the end of a short street on the west edge of Potshot. The yard had no grass. It was sand and stones and several cactus plants. Somehow it managed to look well-kept, though I wasn't sure how one kept a stone patch well. Behind the house was a stable and a rail-fenced corral in which several chestnut-colored horses stood in the shade with their heads down, and twitched their skin against the occasional fly willing to endure the heat. I rang the bell. Mary Lou was in blue shorts and a white tank top when she opened the door. She still smelled of good soap.
"It's you," she said.
"Yes, it is," I said. She stepped aside and let me into the air-conditioned house. A yellow lab wearing a red bandana for a collar jumped up and attempted to lap me into submission. Mary Lou pushed her away.
"This is Jessie," she said. "I do my best, but I can't control her."
"And shouldn't," I said. I bent down and let Jessie lap me for a bit. Then we all went into Mary Lou's gleaming kitchen. The house was so polished and swept and scrubbed and waxed and ironed and starched that it felt as if I were making a mess just by walking through it. Mary Lou and I sat across from each other at a small bleached oak table. Jessie sat on the floor next to it and looked up with her mouth open and her tongue hanging out. Her tail thumped on the floor.
"This is a dog who's been fed from the table," I said. "Do you disapprove?"
"No. Dogs are supposed to be fed from the table."
"Do you have a dog?"
"Susan and I share a German shorthair named Pearl," I said.
"That helps," Mary Lou said.
"If you're going to hire a thug, it's better to hire one who likes dogs?"
She smiled. "Yes, something like that," she said. "Will you have coffee?"
"Sure," I said. While she was making the coffee, Jessie kept shifting her attention from Mary Lou to me. Food can come from anywhere.
"What have you been up to?" Mary Lou said.
"Well, Mrs. Buckman,
please call me Lou."
I nodded. "Mostly I've been orienting. I talked with the bartender at the hotel. He knew less than Jessie here. I talked with some guy in a gun shop. He knew less than the bartender. I talked with the chief of police."
"Dean Walker," she said. "He asked me out a couple of times."
"And?"
"And I'm not ready to date yet," she said. "Maybe in a while."
"He was very interested in who hired me," I said. "He asked a couple of times if it were you."
"What did you say?"
I ignored the question.
"Everyone will know soon enough," she said. "Who else would it be?"
"Your husband have family?" I said.
"No."
"Could I get a list of the names of people you knew pretty well?" I said. "People I can talk to?"
"Yes, can you wait? I'll have to think."
"Sure." She got a Bic pen and a white pad with purple lines on it, and sat and made a short list of names, pausing now and then to think.
"I'm sure I've left people out," she said, "but these are the ones I can think of."
The list wasn't very long. It was limited to Potshot. There was no one on it from L.A.
"It's a start," I said.
"You won't be..." "No. I hired you to investigate. You should just go ahead and do it."
I smiled. "I won't be mean to them," I said. Lou looked at me for a time without speaking, patting Jessie's head absently, her coffee sitting in its pretty china cup, undrunk. The insistent desert light, cooled but not dimmed by technology, came in through the kitchen windows and made everything gleam impossibly. The counters and cabinets were bleached oak. The floor and countertops were Mexican tile. The hood over the cook stove was also tiled in the same stuff. The dog's tail moved steadily as Lou stroked her head.
"It took a long time after Steve died for Jessie to realize he wasn't coming home. Every night before supper she'd go and sit at the door and wait."
I didn't say anything. I wasn't sure she was talking to me.
"It was hard to get her to eat for a while, because Steve was always the one who fed her, and for whatever dog reason, she wanted to wait for him."
I finished my coffee. Lou stopped talking and stared off through the kitchen window at the desert. We looked at each other. She was wearing a light perfume. Her legs were evenly tanned, as well as her arms and face, and probably parts of her I couldn't see. She looked athletic and outdoorsy and clean and very beautiful. The moment took a long time to pass.
"Not too much is known about dogs," I said.
Chapter 4. I started with the first name on Mary Lou's list, J. George Taylor. I was wearing my casual desert detective outfit, ornate sneakers, jeans, a gray T-shirt hanging out to cover the gun, a blue Brooklyn Dodgers baseball hat and shades. I paused to admire my reflection in the tinted glass door, then went into a real estate office on the main drag next to the Foothills Bank and Trust. The office was a small, round-edged, flat-roofed adobe standalone, with a low porch across the front and the overhang of the roof rafters exposed, giving it that authentic Mexican look. There were four small gray metal desks in the room with phones and nameplates and swivel chairs, and chairs handily arranged so that customers could rest their checkbooks on the desk as they wrote. In the back of the room was a big oak desk. There were a number of desert-themed prints on the wall, bleached cow skulls, a big cactus, and Native Americans wrapped in colorful blankets, one of whom wore a derby hat with a feather in it. Three of the small inauthentic desks were empty. A woman with a lot of rigid blonde hair was sitting at the fourth, talking to a fat guy at the big oak desk. Her makeup was expert and extensive. She was wearing a green top and white pants. Her legs were crossed. Where the fabric pulled tight, I noticed that she had a comely, if mature, thigh. Nothing wrong with mature. He had a red face and a lot of male-pattern baldness. He reminded me of Friar Tuck. The room felt like a meat locker, but the red-faced guy was sweating lightly. Her nameplate said B. Taylor. His nameplate said J. George Taylor. Being a trained investigator, I made the connection.
"Hi," she said. "Come in and sit down."
"You want to buy some property?" he said with a big smile. "This is the place."
I took out two business cards and handed one to each and sat down in a convenient customer chair. "Actually, I'm in the market for information," I said. They looked at my card. He said,
"A private detective?"
She said, "I said to myself when you walked in that door, there's something unusual about that man."
"You're both on the money," I said. "I'm looking into the murder of a man named Steve Buckman."
"Somebody hired you?" J. George said.
"Fortunately, yes," I said. "Can either of you help me at all?"
"Do you have a gun?"
the blonde asked. Somehow she made it sound as if she were asking something intimate. I smiled at her. The big smile. The kind that would make her mature thighs ripple.
"Are you Mrs. Taylor?" I said.
"Yes, I'm sorry, and this is my husband, George."
J. George nodded like a guy accepting an award. Either he had more stamina than he showed, or she fooled around. I glanced at her again. She had her lips open slightly. She touched the bottom one with the tip of her tongue. Probably both.
"I can't think of anything we could tell you about Steve," Taylor said.
"You knew him?" I said.
"Oh, sure thing," J. George said. "My business, you get to know pretty much everybody in town."
"Our business, dear."
J. George laughed, jolly.
"B.B. doesn't let you get away with anything," he said.
"I can see that," I said. Flattering B.B. held promise. What kind of a guy was Buckman?
"Steve was a peach," B.B. said. "Wasn't he, George?"
"A peach of a guy," J. George said. "Organized the kids around here into a Pop Warner League."
"I didn't know the town had enough kids for that," I said.
"Six-man football," J. George said.
"Did you ever play football, Mr. Spencer?"
B.B. asked. "A long time ago, Mrs. Taylor. You know, leather helmets and high tops."
"What position did you play?"
"Strong safety," I said.
"I'm not surprised," she said,
and ran the tip of her tongue along her lower lip. My guess was she didn't know strong safety from traffic safety, but she recognized the word strong. I was glad I hadn't played weak side linebacker. "So Buckman was active in the community," I said, just to be saying something. B.B. smiled, as if she knew a joke she wasn't sharing.
"Great guy," J. George said. "It's a real tragedy what happened."
"What did happen?" I said.
"Well," J. George said, "you know he got shot."
"Yes."
"Well, that's all we know."
"No idea who shot him."
"No," J. George said quickly. "Of course not."
"He have any enemies?" I said.
"No," J. George said. "None. Not that I know of."
"How'd he get along with the Dell?" I said.
"Dell? I'm sure I don't know," J. George said.
"I heard they extort money from town businesses, and Steve wouldn't pay."
"I don't know anything about that," J. George said.
He was getting less jolly with every question. "They ask you to donate?" I said.
"No," J. George said. "Absolutely not."
I looked at B.B. She was watching the two of us, her mouth ajar, her lower lip tucked slightly under, the tip of her tongue resting on it. "You know anything about that?" I said to her. She seemed startled.
"About
the Dell," I said.
"No, the Dell. No, I don't know anything about that."
"I'm telling you," J. George said, "Steve Buckman didn't have an enemy in the world."
"He had one," I said.
"He did."
"George," B.B. said, "somebody shot him."
"Oh, yeah, sure thing. I'm starting to slow down, I guess."
Again I saw B.B. smile at her private joke. "How was the marriage?" I said.
"Far as I know, solid as a rock," J. George said.
He was getting jolly again. Old J. George, fat and jolly. Probably light on his feet. Probably a ton of laughs at Rotary Club. Probably steal your children in a real estate deal.
"You know about his marriage, B.B. You're friendly with Lou."
"Lou?" I said.
"Lou Buckman," J. George said. "His wife. Didn't she hire you?"
I smiled. Enigmatic. "They get along," I said to B.B.
"Like George and I," she said.
"That well," I said.
"Oh, sure," J. George said. "Been together for, well, never mind," he laughed. "Don't want to give our age away. We got married when she was 19.
"Wow," I said. 20 years. B.B. smiled almost genuinely.
"How gallant," she said. "Why are you asking about Lou?"
"Just doing the drill," I said. "A spouse dies, the surviving spouse is automatically suspect."
"Cherche la femme,"
B.B. said, and looked pleased with herself. "We," I said.
"You going to be in town long, Mr. Spencer?" J. George said.
"A while," I said. "Could you tell me any people that Buckman was close to in town, people I might talk with?"
"Well, B.B. could do that for you. She really knew him better than I did."
"I'll bet she did."
"Want to give him a list, B.B.?" J. George said. "Just so you are, you know, circumspect and—"
"I wouldn't want people we know to be pestered."
I'll try not to pester, I said.
I don't know why you need this stuff, J. George said. It was some thug from the Dell, anyway.
No doubt, I said. But which one? I'm just looking for information.
B.B. got out a sheet of paper and thought and wrote and thought and wrote. J. George and I sat silently while she wrote, both of us watching her as if it were interesting. When she was through, she handed it to me.
I'm sure it's not everybody, she said, but it's who I could think of.
Thank you, I said.
Anything I can do, she said.
I nodded. The words had an ulterior ring to them, as if they meant more than they seemed to.
Well, anything you need. B.B. and I know pretty much everything goes on around here.
Except two-shot Steve Buckman, I said.
Except that, J. George said.
He stood. He was taller than I'd thought. Maybe because he was wearing tan snakeskin cowboy boots. Authentic. I stood and shook hands with him. B.B. stood when I did.
"Sit still, George," she said. "I'll walk him to the door."
She did. When I stepped out onto the covered porch, the heat rammed into me like a physical thing. B.B. stepped out with me. "Do you get used to the heat?" I said.
"I like heat," she said.
She moistened her lower lip. I could feel one of those comely, mature thighs against my own. "Besides," I said, "it's a dry heat."
Everyone says that, don't they?
Everyone, I said.
Where are you staying? She said.
Jackrabbit Inn. She put her hand out. I took it.
Nice to have met you, Mr. Spencer, she said.
You too, I said.
If I think of anything, perhaps I'll call you, she said.
Anything at all, I said. She smiled and stared into my eyes.
Yes, she said.
Chapter 5
I compared the list from Lou Buckman with the list from B.B. Taylor. B.B.'s list started with a guy named Mark Ratliff. Mary Lou's list didn't name him. Since I assumed he was first on B.B.'s list because he was the first one she thought of, he seemed a good choice to visit next. Ratliff had his office in a corner building with a rounded false front that made it look like a 19th-century saloon. There was a glass window to the right of the entry door in which hung a stained glass sign that read, Tumbleweed Productions. I went in. The reception area was lined with movie posters. The furniture was blonde modern and looked very uncomfortable. At the reception desk was a tanned young woman in a lavender pantsuit. Her dark hair was long and straight. There was a dandy silver streak in the front. She wore large round glasses with gold frames. Her long, manicured nails were painted to match her pantsuit, and an ornate sapphire and gold ring on the index finger of her right hand. The nameplate on the desk said, Vicky.
"May I help you?" she said.
I gave her my card. It was a nice, subdued card. Susan had persuaded me not to use one with the picture of me holding a knife in my teeth. "I'd like to see Mark Ratliff, please." Vicky studied my card for a moment.
"Do you have an appointment with Mr. Ratliff?" she said.
"I'm ashamed to say I don't." I smiled at Vicky even more forcefully than I had at B.B., though not the A smile. The A smile was too dangerous. Women sometimes began to loosen their clothing when I gave them the A smile.
"What was it concerning, Mr. Spencer?"
"Steve Buckman," I said.
"The man who was—"
I nodded encouragingly.
"I'll see if Mr. Ratliff is free," she said,
and went up a circular staircase in the back corner of the room and along a balcony and into an office. While she was gone, I looked at the movie posters. All of them had Ratliff's name attached as producer. Some of them had stars I'd heard of. There was also an article clipped from Variety and framed, in which Ratliff was referred to as Cult Film Master Mark Ratliff, which I think meant that his films didn't make money. I was still looking at the posters and listening to the white noise of the air conditioning when Vicky came back with good news.
"Mr. Ratliff will see you," she said,
as if she were announcing, "It's a boy." "How nice," I said.
"Top of the stairs, turn right," she said.
She smiled at me as if we were co-conspirators. I smiled back. Pals. One of my best friends in Potshot. I went up the stairs. Mark Ratliff was sitting behind a huge, hand-carved Mexican-looking desk. He had on a light blue satin sweatsuit. He wore small, gold-rimmed glasses low on his nose. His hair was white blonde and brighter than BB's. He was very dark, and the light coming in through the window behind him illuminated the contrast between his dark skin and his pale hair. He stood when I came in and looked at me over the glasses.
"Hi," he said. "Mark Ratliff."
The introduction was superfluous. I obviously knew who he was, but I didn't make a fuss about it. I said hello and sat down.
"So," he said, "poor Stevie."
"You close to him?" I said.
"My best friend," Ratliff said.
"How about Mrs. Buckman?" I said.
"Oh, sure, Lou and I were pals too, but Stevie was the one."
"Any idea who might have wanted to kill him?"
"God, I wish I knew which one," he said.
"Which one of what?" I said.
"Of those bastards in the Dell. Everybody knows it was one of them."
"He had trouble with someone from the Dell?"
"Sure, haven't you even found that out yet?"
"I'm new in town," I said. "Tell me about it." He looked at me for a moment.
"You're jerking my chain, aren't you, Spence? You know more than you're letting on."
"I'd like to hear your version," I said.
"Compare stories. See if you can catch somebody lying," he said. "I know how that works."
I nodded.
"Well, as I understand it, he got into a beef with a couple of guys from the Dell."
"Because?"
"I guess they wanted to extort some money from him. He had that little horseback tour business, you know."
"And?"
"And Stevie was a tough kid, played football, been in the Marines. He told them to take a walk."
"And?"
"They killed him. Show everybody what might happen if they didn't cooperate with the Dell."
"Do you cooperate?"
"Sure," he said. "Cost of doing business."
"You could move."
"I came out here to get away from the whole L.A. scene," he said. "Agents, managers, lawyers, phonies, backstabbing as a way of life? No thanks."
I thought there might be other options besides L.A., but it wasn't something I cared to argue about.
"You make films, you get used to paying off people," he said. "Happens everywhere."
"Uh-huh."
"That's what I do," Ratliff said. "It's my passion. I make the films I want to make, and I do it on my terms."
"If the deal is right," I said. He grinned.
"Hey, Spence, nothing's perfect."
"Can you think of anyone other than the farmers in the Dell who might have had anything against Buckman?"
"Stevie? No, he was a straight guy, up front. You knew where he stood."
"People like that sometimes make enemies," I said.
"Steve was a good guy. Everybody liked him."
"Me too," I said. "How about his marriage?"
"Man, it was beautiful," Ratliff said. "Soulmates. I'm telling you, it's a goddamn shame."
"So you know it was the Dell, but you don't know who in the Dell."
"That's it exactly," Ratliff said.
"Anyone but Buckman ever stand up to them?"
"Not that I know about, and certainly not since they killed Stevie."
"The object lesson worked," I said.
"I'm afraid it did," Ratliff said. "You think you can crack this?"
"Sure," I said.
"Well, you know," Ratliff leaned back in his chair and laced his fingers behind his head, "if you do it, it would make a hell of a story."
"You gonna make me a star?" I said.
"I could make a hell of a film out of your story. You pulled this off," he said. "You be interested in a small option against a big purchase? I'll be straight with you. It'd be only if you solve this."
"Who plays me?" I said. Ratliff smiled.
"It's a little early for casting, Spence."
"Yeah, but it's crucial," I said.
"Well, you could certainly consult on the casting. Probably give a credit, separate card."
"I'll get back to you," I said.
"Think about it," Ratliff said. "I'm telling you."
Chapter 6
I talked to 5 more people that day and learned a little less from each one. Everybody agreed that it was those bastards in the Dell. Everybody believed that Steve was a prince and Lou was a princess. I was sick of it. Back in the artificial chill of my hotel room, I put my gun on the bedside table, flopped on the bed with my shoes on, and called Susan. She would be through seeing patients. It was always complicated calling her when I was away. As soon as I heard her voice, I felt better, and as soon as I hung up, I felt worse. But knowing I could call her again made me feel better. There was nothing definably unusual about her voice, but there were colors in it, overtones of intelligence, hints of passion, an undercurrent of completeness. It was the voice of a beautiful woman, the voice of someone willing to try anything once. "What's happening?" she said.
"I've been running around asking questions and seeding the clouds," I said.
"As in making rain?"
"As in letting everyone know I'm looking into Steve Buckman's death."
There was a pause. I imagined her sitting on her couch with her legs tucked up under her, the way she did, and her head tilted a little as she talked into the phone, and Pearl the Wonder Dog sprawled beside her with her head hanging over the edge of the couch cushion.
"You're doing it again," she said.
"What?"
"Pushing," she said. "Pushing until someone pushes back."
"Then I know who I'm pushing," I said.
There was another pause while she decided not to pursue the issue. "Have you seen your client?" she said.
"Yep."
"How about this gang up in the woods?"
"Hills, actually," I said.
"But that's who we're talking about."
"Yes."
"Have you seen them?"
"Not yet."
"But you will," Susan said.
"But I will."
"Have you talked with the local police?"
"Guy named Walker," I said. "Affable, open, friendly, straightforward. I don't believe anything he says."
"Man's intuition?"
"I've been getting lied to for a lot of years now," I said. "I'm getting good at recognizing it."
"Is she cute?" Susan said.
"Who?"
"Mary Lou Whatsis," Susan said.
I smiled happily in my cold hotel room.
"Very," I said. "I told you that before."
"Is she cuter than moi?"
"No one is cuter than two," I said. She was quiet. So was I. There was nothing awkward in the silence. I knew she was thinking. I waited.
"I don't want you to get hurt," Susan said.
"Me either," I said.
"And I worry when you put yourself out as a lure."
"Me too," I said.
"But you do it anyway."
"Seems like a good idea sometimes," I said.
"Because?"
"Because I don't know what else to do," I said.
"So, in other words, I'm in love with a brave idiot."
"Better than a scared one," I said.
"Sometimes."
Susan paused again. I listened to the soundless distance between us.
"Better than not being in love with one," she said.
"Any idiot in a storm," I said.
"How long are you planning to be out there luring the gang from the woods?"
"Hills. I don't know."
"Why don't you find the murderer quickly and come home?"
"What a very good idea," I said.
"Just a suggestion," Susan said.
"Would you like to swap sexual innuendos for a while?" I said.
"Of course," Susan said.
So, we did.
Chapter 7
I parked my rental Ford at the mouth of a narrow dirt road that struggled through the scrub growth and cacti of the low mountains into a short valley, which, according to the map Mary Lou had given me, was called the Dell. I wasn't high enough up to be any cooler, and the heat pressed in on me as I waded through it up the road. There was no sound except the hum of insects in the scrub. I was wearing sneakers and jeans and a T-shirt. I left the T-shirt hanging out over my belt to cover the 9mm Browning I had brought, no sense offending the sensibilities of the folks in the Dell. A half mile in, the dirt road opened up into a grassless clearing, with a main house and several Quonset huts scattered about it, and 100 yards upgrade, the opening of a mine shaft that looked like Hellmouth in an Elizabethan play. There were a couple of four-wheel drive vehicles parked near the main house, and several all-terrain scooters and a herd of motorcycles. The house had a veranda, and on it were a half-dozen men and women doing nothing. The men's uniform tended to be motorcycle boots, jeans, T-shirts, and black leather vests.
The women weren't wearing vests. From a long quonset came the smell of onions frying. There was a satellite dish on the roof of the house, and I could hear television noise.
"How y'all doing today?" I said when I was close enough to the veranda.
Everyone stared at me.
"Hot enough for you?" I said.
One of the men, or maybe two, got up and came to the top step. He was maybe 6'5", with shoulder-length hair, and he weighed maybe 280.
"Who the hell are you?" he said.
"Spencer. I'm looking for the preacher."
"No shit," the big man said.
"None," I said. Men and a few women came out of the other buildings and stood, staring at me. There might have been 50 people. The weight of the Browning on my hip felt mildly reassuring. I would have preferred intensely reassuring.
"What you want to see the preacher for?" the man said.
"I'm trying to find out what happened to Steve Buckman," I said. The big man frowned a little, concentrating. Then he smiled.
"Steve Buckman," he said. "He got shot dead."
"I'm trying to find out by whom," I said. A fat guy on the veranda said,
"Whom?"
And everybody laughed. I smiled. Easy going. A guy who could take a joke.
"We heard about that," the big man said. "You're the guy."
"I'm the guy," I said.
"Matter of fact," he said, "preacher wants to talk with you."
"Good." The big man turned and walked across the veranda and went through the screen door into the house. In a moment he came back with another man half his size, who radiated an interior kinetic ferocity that made size irrelevant. "You the preacher?" I said. The man nodded once. He was slender and pale and hairless. He had no eyebrows, and there was no hint of a beard. He wore a black dress shirt buttoned to the neck, black slacks, and black sandals with black socks. Consistent. He had very little chin. His mouth was thin and sharp and sort of underslung like a shark's. "I'm trying to find out who shot a man named Stephen Buckman." The preacher nodded again, once.
"Do you know who did it?" I said.
The preacher stared at me without speaking. I waited. Finally he said,
"You come out here alone?"
His voice was raspy and so soft I could barely hear him, but it had a discernible chill. I did.
"Who hired you to bother us about Buckman?"
"Nobody," I said. "I'm just a nosy guy."
"We could stomp it out of you."
"Some of you would get hurt," I said. The preacher smiled, sort of. He probably meant it to be a smile.
"You got a pair of balls," he said softly. "I'll give you that."
"Thank you," I said. "Can we sit somewhere and talk?" The big man with the long hair said to the preacher,
"Want me to stomp his ass?"
"Not yet, pony."
We all stood without saying anything. It was like one of those awkward pauses in routine conversations where everyone is frantically thinking of something to say.
"We'll take a walk," the preacher said.
He came down off the veranda. Pony came right behind him. The preacher shook his head.
"Just me and him," the preacher said.
Pony looked a little hurt, but he stayed where he was. The preacher nodded at me and we walked around the house. There was a view back there. The land dropped away sharply, almost a cliff, and the town and the desert beyond it stretched out like a Bierstadt painting. There was a wooden bench near the edge of the drop, a wide plank nailed on the top of two tree stumps.
"Sit,"
the preacher said. "Nice view," I said.
"Uh-huh."
It was a strain listening to the preacher's barely audible voice. "You know who shot Steve Buckman?" I said.
"What I know," he whispered, "and what I'll tell you ain't got much to do with each other."
"What do you know about me?" I said.
"Your name's Spencer. You're a private shoe-fly from Boston. Somebody hired you to see who killed Buckman."
"You know a lot," I said.
"I'm supposed to," he said.
"So you have sources in town," I said. The preacher was staring out at the view. He had high, narrow shoulders, I noticed. When he sat, they sort of hunched up so that seen from below, he'd look like a gargoyle on a medieval tower.
"You let everybody know pretty quick," the preacher said, "what you were doing here."
I nodded.
"I figure that was on purpose," preacher said. "I figure you're poking a stick into the hornet's nest. See what comes flying out."
"Uh-huh."
"And now you come poking up here."
"Seemed like a good place to poke," I said.
"If you don't get stung."
"Exactly," I said. The preacher made his dreadful smile face again.
"What I'm wondering about is how she picked you all the way from Boston. You famous?"
I nodded. "For my wit and charm," I said.
"So I figure you must be pretty good," the preacher said.
"There's that," I said.
"I'm pretty good myself."
"How nice for you," I said.
"And I got 40 men with me."
"Even nicer," I said.
"So you're clear on it."
"So who killed Steve Buckman?" I said. The preacher croaked an audible version of his smile. It was like hearing a shark laugh.
"He who keep after it," the preacher said.
"Uh-huh."
"Would you believe me if I told you it was nobody from the Dell?"
"Not so much that I declare it solved and go home," I said.
"I'll tell you anyway."
"Did you threaten him?"
"I authorized it," the preacher said.
"Because?"
"Because he wouldn't abide by the rules."
"Your rules?" The preacher nodded.
"Dell rules," he said. "You can look out there, and you can see that it ain't a huge fuck of a lot. But it's enough, and it belongs to us."
"Like a carcass belongs to vultures," I said. The preacher smiled without showing any teeth. They were probably pointed.
"Except that it ain't dead," he said.
"And Buckman?"
"We charged him rent for his business. He refused to pay it. He was told there would be a penalty."
"That bring him around," I said.
"No."
"So?"
"So somebody shot him," the preacher said.
"Not you?"
"Not none of us. We was going to stomp his sorry ass, but we'd rather have him alive and earning so he could pay his rent."
"How about his widow?" I said. "I understand she runs the business now."
"We'll get to her," the preacher said. "We thought we'd let the murder thing sort of burn out before we hit on her."
"Grieving widow," I said.
"Sure,"
the preacher said.
"Sheriff's detectives," I said.
"Sure."
"So that's the local industry here in the Dell," I said, "living off the town?"
"We was here first," the preacher said.
"We was?"
"Been people in the Dell since the Mexican War."
"Your ancestors," I said.
"What you might call spiritual ancestors,"
the preacher said.
"Been people like us living here 160 years.
"Supporting themselves off the town," I said.
"Hell," the preacher said, "we was the town at first. Then the mine went dry and all the fucking yuppies moved in. There's the money. Might as well take it."
"Whether they want to give it or not."
"You think lambs want to get eaten by wolves?" the preacher said.
"So are you really a preacher?"
"I preach," he said.
"What?"
"What do I preach?"
"Uh-huh."
"I preach self-reliance," he said.
He didn't seem to be kidding. "You and Emerson," I said.
"Who's Emerson?"
"One of the Concord Transcendentalists," I said. He frowned. I seemed to be serious.
"Are you fucking with me?"
the preacher said. "Sometimes I can't help myself." He stared at me like some kind of reptilian predator. I could feel it in the small recesses of my stomach.
"Could get you hurt really bad," he said.
"How long you been here?" I said.
"I come here about 10 years ago, the preacher said. "Found a bunch of degenerate bums, no rules, no ambition, fighting each other over booze and dope and women. I put in some rules, turned them into something."
"What rules?"
"No dope. No hard booze. No fighting with each other. No unattached bras. Any women come here, the man that brought them is responsible for them. You fight with one of us. You fight with all of us.
You gave them pride, I said. He studied me again. This time his gaze was no less reptilian, but it wasn't predatory.
Yeah, he whispered. You might say so.
Probably got some for yourself, I said. He stared out over the desert flats below us for a time. The heat shimmered up over the town.
You might be a smart fella, he said after a time.
I might be, I said. He looked closely at his fingertips as he rubbed them together. The temperature was ferociously hot. I knew I was sweating, but the sweat evaporated almost instantly in the dry air.
I come in here, the preacher said. These people were lying around here like zoo animals, he said. Farting, fucking, fighting over the women. Dope, booze. They ran out of money, they'd boost something in town or beg. Nobody cleaned the barracks. Nobody washed themselves. The place stunk.
I nodded. You know Buckman, I said.
I knew him.
Know his wife?
Enough,
the preacher said. You got any thought who shot him?
You're like a fucking dog with a fucking bone, the preacher said. Maybe she shot him.
Mrs. Buckman?
Could be.
Got any reason to think so? The preacher laughed his dry, ugly laugh.
Cherche la fucking femme, he said. Ain't that right?
Him too. Sometimes.
More than sometimes, the preacher said. Broads are trouble.
I take it you're not a feminist, I said.
A what?
Never mind. The feral ferocity came back into his look.
You fucking with me again, he said.
Only a little, I said.
You take some bad chances, Boston.
Keeps me young, I said. The preacher cackled. It was a startling sound.
Well, you go ahead and find out who killed old Stevie Buckman, the preacher said. And good luck with it, long as you stay out of our way.
Do what I can, I said. Chapter 8 Back at the Jackrabbit Inn, I went to the bar. I liked air-conditioned bars on hot afternoons, when there weren't many people there and it was quiet and sort of dim. They had Coors on draft. I ordered some, and it arrived in a chilled glass. Perfect. When I had drunk half of it, I turned and rested my elbows on the bar and looked around the room. The walls were paneled in bleached oak. There were some Georgia O'Keeffe prints. Behind the bar was a mirror, with the booze stacked in front of it, backlit so it looked enticing. Above the mirror was a large painting of a nude woman with a red silk scarf over her pelvis. I finished the beer and ordered another one. The doors to the bar were bat-winged. Posted on the wall to either side were an assortment of fake wanted posters. The whole look made me want to wear my gun low in a tooled holster. Except the gun was real.
"No one should drink alone," someone said, and
B.B. Taylor slid her good-looking butt onto a bar stool next to me.
"So I'm volunteering," she said.
"Tough, dirty work," I said.
"But someone has to do it," B.B. said. "I drink gimlets."
I gestured the bartender down and ordered for her. "Why aren't you out selling a house?" I said.
"I came down here to see you," she said.
The gimlet arrived, and she picked it up and held it toward the light.
"I think one reason I like these is that they look so nice," she said.
"Any reason's a good one," I said, just to be saying something. "Why did you want to see me?"
"Your nose has been broken," she said.
"Thank you for noticing," I said.
"I like men whose nose has been broken," she said.
"That's why I had it done."
"And," she said, "I like men who are silly."
"Well, little lady, you've got the right hombre." She smiled. Each of us drank.
"You know, you're something of a hunk," B.B. said.
A middle-aged couple in shorts and tank tops came in and sat at the end of the bar and ordered vodka and tonics and something called Alamo Burgers. "What the hell is an Alamo burger?" I said to Bebe.
"A cheeseburger with a chili pepper on it."
"Let the good times roll," I said.
"You're a big one, aren't you?" Bebe said.
"Just the right size for my clothes," I said. Bebe